Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
A double shot of hope. Pfizer seeks authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine for young children. One day after the WHO approves the first ever malaria vaccine, Dr. Sanjay Gupta talks about both potential breakthroughs as well as his new book, World War C. Then, Ethiopians are pushed to the brink of starvation as new accusations are leveled against the government. I ask Republican Congressman Michael McCaul what the United States is prepared to do to stop the conflict. Plus,
everybody say yeah! Yeah!
12 young boys trapped deep in a cave in Thailand get live to tell the tale. Hari Srinivasan talks to Academy Award-winning directors Elizabeth Chai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin about their new film, The Rescue. And what it's really like to go to outer space. Astronaut Chris Cassidy takes us inside his final mission among the stars.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Goladriga in New York, sitting in for Christian Amanpour. As the COVID pandemic rages on, some welcome news in the fight against another deadly infectious disease, malaria. The World Health Organization approved the first ever malaria vaccine for use among children, a potential game-changing achievement as the mosquito-borne disease kills more than 260,000 African children under the age of five every year. Here's the WHO Secretary General.
We still have a very long road to travel, but this is a long stride down that road. This vaccine is a gift to the world.
Meanwhile, here in the United States, Pfizer is formally asking the FDA for emergency use authorization for its COVID vaccine for children for the ages of 5 to 11. This as two real-world studies confirm immune protection from Pfizer's adult vaccine begins to wane after 2 months, though the protection against severe disease remains strong. Here to discuss all of this is our very own Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who's out with a new book. I don't know where he finds the time, but this book is called World War C, Lessons Learned from the COVID-19 Pandemic and How to Prepare for the Next One. Dr. Gupta joins me now from New York. Sanjay, always great to see you, especially when there is some good news. With this news that Pfizer is seeking this emergency use authorization for children ages 5 to 11, how soon can we realistically see this vaccine administered?
Well, you know, they're submitting the data, which means they feel pretty comfortable that the data is going to look good. And we know that the FDA in the United States has already scheduled a meeting on October 26th. So this is an advisory committee, Bianca. It's an open committee meeting. Anybody can watch it. And at the end of that, they make a recommendation to the FDA. If it follows the similar pattern as it has with the previous authorizations of the vaccines, then, you know, the FDA could authorize the next day. The CDC could recommend a couple of days after that. So potentially by Halloween in the United States, that vaccine could be authorized. Now, obviously, we got to see how this plays out. I mean, we're just hearing from the company so far, but it looks promising. And do keep in mind, because I know you have family, your family's directly impacted by this. After the authorization, one shot, and then 3 weeks later, a second shot, and then it's 2 weeks after that before someone would actually be considered vaccinated. So there is a little bit of a time even after an authorization happens. But again, it looks promising for, you know, the next couple of months to be able to have many people in that age group vaccinated.
And they are advising one-third of the dose used for adults, correct?
Yes, a good point. Typically it's 30 micrograms. This would be 10 micrograms. They found that smaller dose still created enough of those neutralizing antibodies in children aged 5 to 11. So I think it'll also lead to fewer side effects probably as well, you know, the sore arm and things like that people get.
Yeah, well, listen, as you mentioned, my kids, I am ready to line them up and get those shots as soon as possible. And fortunately, this has not been a virus that has targeted young children, though because of the Delta variant, 1 in 4 children have been infected as of last month. So this really is going to impact kids ages 5 to 11. Of course, the question is, will all parents agree to vaccinate their children? And one alarming survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation said that roughly a third of parents of children between the ages of 5 and 11 say they want to wait and see before allowing their children to be vaccinated. One can understand, of course, that a parent wants to be utmost, you know, prepared and that their children will be safe. But does that alarm you at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a concern all along. I feel like for the last year, you know, the hesitancy around the vaccines has been a big issue. I think with young children in particular, first of all, I think if the FDA does authorize that, you'll see the numbers change a bit. We always do. I think people will see that as a bit of an affirmation, Bianna. I think the other thing is that, you know, it's got to be a reminder, as you say, that a lot of parents say, look, my kid's not really at risk for this. So why am I doing this? And I think you have to make the case that the risk is much smaller. It's not zero. It's a safe vaccine. And there's a larger component to this, which is we're getting really close to potentially being able to look at this pandemic in the rearview mirror, not ending it, but really controlling it. And one way to get there is to have more people vaccinated. So it is, you know, the appeal, I think, from pediatricians to parents and to young kids is going to be the collective as much as the individual.
Look, any way we can get back to some sense of normal, right? Sense of normalcy where they don't have to wear masks at schools and they can have those play dates once again and big birthday parties. But let's talk about the trajectory that we've been seeing over the past few weeks, because it is a good one. The infection rate has been dropping. The hospitalization rate has been dropping. But many are warning that it's too soon to declare victory as we're approaching the winter months. And once again, we're at flu season.
Yeah, I think we have to be humble. There's no question. I mean, I've learned more humility over the last couple of years, I think, than anybody. But the reason people, I think, are optimistic is because of the trends that you're describing, Bianna. But also, if you look around the world at countries that would be considered slightly ahead of us in their own trajectories, you do see numbers coming down and staying down. We are going into a cooler season, cooler and drier. That's when pathogens like to spread. So that's the balance. That's the concern. But let me show you. I also looked back historically, back in 2009 and even 1918. I don't know if we have those graphics, but basically what you saw in 2009 was the most significant surge was right around this time. The numbers started to drop and they stayed low. In 1918, sort of a similar thing. There was a smaller surge sort of in February of the following year, but pretty much after this October surge, the numbers stayed down through the winter. Now, why is that? Part of it, I think, is because you do have the vaccines, obviously been higher percentages in some countries versus others. But because of this Delta variant, as you mentioned, Bianna, it's so contagious. So many people have been exposed that you have to add the natural immunity into that as well. Mm-hmm. So between the two, I think going into the winter, you have a lot more immunity. How long it lasts, that's going to be a big question. But I think it kind of gets us through this particularly concerning season potentially.
Let me quickly ask you about boosters, because in the intro to you, I noted that Pfizer has reported that the efficacy, the efficacy rate of the vaccine begins to decline after 2 months, though it is still very strong and effective to avoid hospitalizations, right, which is the key point there. But I read a headline today from the Wall Street Journal that the White House is also concerned about long COVID. Now, this isn't something that you're seeing very prevalent throughout the country, but it does exist, and we do hear of cases. And they are pretty detailed and chronic. And that is something, obviously, we want to avoid. Does that make more of an argument for a booster shot now and for those that are younger than the age of 65 in particular?
Well, it's a really good question, and it came up quite a bit during these FDA meetings. And ultimately, you know where they landed, which was to recommend boosters for people over the age of 65 and people who have chronic medical conditions that put them at risk, which is a large percentage of people in this country. If you do the math, Bianna, you're talking, you know, maybe close to 170, 200 million people who have some of these pre-existing conditions. The interesting thing about giving a vaccine even to someone who has previously had COVID is exactly what you said, which is that it may decrease the likelihood of them developing long COVID. There's been some early data to suggest that somehow the vaccine, the creation of these proteins, these antibodies, may be decreasing the likelihood of long COVID or shortening its duration. And I'll tell you, it's not an insignificant concern. I mean, some studies, Bianca, say a third of people will have symptoms that linger months. And, you know, sometimes it's young people just taking these super long naps every day. They're so tired all the time. It can be other people with headaches and chronic fatigue or loss of smell, things like that we've heard. So some of these symptoms can last a long time, and that extra dose could help.
Yeah, they are very frightening, what we're hearing, some of these chronic issues and symptoms that people are reporting now. So let's move on to this other headline, because if we weren't in the middle of a pandemic, this would have led the show. And this is this new vaccine that the World Health Organization has announced against malaria, the first of its kind. The efficacy rate is at 50%, so obviously much lower than the Pfizer vaccine that we were just talking about, and Moderna as well. Nonetheless, how big of a game changer is this?
I think, you know, scientifically, this is a really big deal. I mean, people think of vaccines all the same, but vaccines against a virus versus a vaccine against a parasite, which is what causes malaria, that's a big deal. It's never been done before. I mean, it's, you know, since I was in medical school, people have been talking about this in 100 years, you know, there's been development work on this. So just for what it is, it's a big deal. As you point out, the efficacy is low, and it lower than, you know, we're used to hearing for COVID, for example, and it drops off as well. So the way this vaccine works is you get three shots between the ages of 5 and 17 months, and then another shot 18 months later. So, you know, it kind of gets children through that acute childhood period, but then the effectiveness does wear off. I think the issue is you got 500,000 people who die of malaria every year, mostly in the developing world, and about half, a little less than half, are children under the age of 5. So it could be significant for them. I will tell you, having just reported on this area a lot, scientifically this is a big deal. They're going to have to make the case to the Global Vaccine Alliance that it's worth the cost, because, you know, they got a lot of priorities. And you say, well, look, is this worth 30% efficacy? That'll save how many lives over what period of time? And with COVID and all the other sort of priorities they have. So WHO recommends it. Now we got to see if Gavi and other organizations buy it.
Yeah, WHO director calling it a gift. Let's talk about what you have written and what you have brought us every single day over nearly 2 years, because you are our gift, Sanjay Gupta. I talked to you before we were on air, and I asked how you found the time to write a book now. And you said it was basically just putting to paper everything that you've been observing and covering throughout this pandemic. And just from a larger picture perspective, I think the first question still must be asked is, how the U.S., which had been ranked number one in pandemic preparedness, would have stumbled so far and so fast?
Yeah, it's a really remarkable story. I mean, you know, that's the thing, is that we don't have the context for this, right? The last time we had a pandemic this bad was in 1918. So when Johns Hopkins put together that preparedness index, the United States was ranked one, as you say. But I don't know how you can take into account exactly how things play out, how seriously people would take something like this in the beginning, human behavior overall. It's very hard to model those things, Bianca, I think, which is one of the things that really struck me. I've been talking to so many scientists, but also psychologists and behavioral experts about this issue for the book. I mean, just how you even evaluate risk. If you live in a country like the United States, plenty of resources, you know, this isn't something that's going to affect us as much as it'll affect other places. If that's the mentality and you hear something as 0.5% lethal, there's a group of people who will say 0.5% lethal. That means 1 in 200 people will die. We need to be careful. We need to protect ourselves. But for a lot of people, they'll say, well, that means I'm 99.5% good, right? What's the big deal? And it leads to all these behavioral sort of manifestations, you know, individually, but also at a societal level, that I think really put us in tough shape. I will also say, like, if you take a look at South Korea, I don't know if we have this graphic of South Korea and the United States, but I showed this because a patient was diagnosed on the same day in both these places. South Korea is about a sixth the size of the United States. We had, you know, 45 million confirmed cases in the United States. They had 300,000. There was no magic therapeutic. They obviously didn't have a vaccine ahead of us. It was just basic public health practices. So if you don't lean into those things early on, it makes a huge difference, bad difference, later on. And I'll just say one more thing, Bianca, and this is a larger issue, I think, for wealthy countries. This pandemic seemed to have affected wealthy countries more so than developing countries. We don't think of things that way. Malaria, as we were just talking about, that's a developing infectious disease, a developing world infectious disease. Diseases of affluence like obesity, diabetes, things like that really made Americans and people, frankly, living in wealthier countries more at risk with regard to this particular pandemic. And that's, I think that's going to be a real lesson going forward.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that a lot of these countries, particularly Asian countries, really stepped up to protect their elderly communities, perhaps in ways that we didn't even do in the United States as well. Sanjay Gupta, can't wait to read this book. Once again, congratulations. Thank you for all of your time, and thank your family for it as well.
Thank you, Vienna. Anytime.
And now we turn to Ethiopia. The Biden administration is warning that the U.S. is prepared to sanction those responsible for ferrying weaponry during Ethiopia's war effort in Tigray. This a response to the stunning CNN investigation, which revealed that Ethiopia's government used Ethiopian Airlines, the country's flagship commercial carrier, to shuttle weapons to and from neighboring Eritrea during the first weeks of the Tigray conflict. Here to discuss this and other pressing matters, the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Michael McCaul. Congressman, welcome to the program from Austin, Texas, one of my favorite cities. Went to school there. Let's delve into this conflict and this exclusive CNN reporting. CNN reporting that the use of their government airlines, Ethiopian Airlines, to shuttle in weaponry from neighboring Eritrea, which is against international law, to fight in the Tigray region. The U.S. has actually issued a statement, the NSC, in response to that, saying that the U.S. government is considering the full range of tools at our disposal to address the worsening crisis in northern Ethiopia, including the use of targeted economic sanctions while mitigating unintended effects on the people of Ethiopia and the wider region. Is that an appropriate response, in your opinion? And if not, what should be?
No, I think it's very appropriate. There was an executive order issued by the president, President Biden, dealing with the threat of sanctions against those responsible. The chairman, and I'm the ranking member on the Foreign Affairs Committee, we have issued a statement calling upon the Biden administration to issue the sanctions moving forward. I think the latest reporting by CNN, actually well done, by the way, to uncover the fact that the Ethiopian government's using their airline to transport military weapons to Eritrea, which is a neighboring country, and becoming an ally of the government of Ethiopia against the Tigrayan population. I think to put all this in context, Beyond, it's important to note this could be one of the worst famines to take place in the 21st century. The Ethiopian government has basically blocked off 90% of supply trucks going into Tigray. It's also, they've harassed aid workers, and they've expelled 7 United Nations workers. So this thing is increasing in its crisis level, not decreasing since the ceasefire. And I think it calls for action with the administration.
Well, Ethiopia, as you know, is on the receiving end of millions of dollars worth of trade benefits from the United States. The U.S. Trade Representative said that she would be willing to look at that deal now and act upon it, given these allegations and what we have even just reported, these gruesome videos that we have been covering for years, for months, thanks to Nima's reporting. Do you think that in fact, we should be reevaluating our trade agreements?
I do. And I think, you know, there's a lot of blame to go around. The Tigrayans initially started to fight back against the government. I think, you know, interestingly, the prime minister got the Nobel Peace Prize, of all things, in his ceasefire with the neighboring country of Eritrea. And now he's one of the grossest violations of potentially war crimes in what he's doing today. And so this latest reporting is very valuable to policymakers in terms of what's happening on the ground. And I think what is unfolding, again, I hearken back to days when I was growing up as a younger, you know, high school student, when we saw the famine in Ethiopia. I think this could be far worse. And it could involve millions of people facing death by starvation.
Right. And I want to ask you from a business perspective, you know, Boeing supplies many of these planes for the Ethiopian Airlines. Should they now be factoring in all of these atrocities? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's a corporate responsibility aspect to human rights violations and violation of the human rights of the Tigrayan population when they are being blockaded 90%. Everything's blocked off from coming in the country since July, causing millions to die from starvation. This is, and I'm really glad that CNN International is reporting this. This is a really unreported story of a famine that's taking place right now in the world that most people are just not aware of. And I think the awareness piece is huge. And I call upon in a bipartisan way President Biden, the administration, to go forward with their announcement, go forward with the authorities we've given them under current law to issue these sanctions against those responsible for this human rights and humanitarian crisis. So we need to look at also whether these are war crimes against humanity and possible genocide as well.
Yeah, and you talk about the responsibility from the business community. Let me ask you about Facebook, because we heard testimony this week in Washington from the whistleblower that used to work at Facebook, Francis Haugen, who testified that Facebook is literally fanning ethnic violence in places like Myanmar and Ethiopia. Let's take a listen.
My fear is that without action, divisive and extremist behaviors we see today are only the beginning. What we saw in Myanmar and are now seeing in Ethiopia are only the opening chapters of a story so terrifying, no one wants to read the end of it. Congress can change the rules that Facebook plays by and stop the many harms it is now causing.
Congressman, do you view Facebook as a national security threat?
I think social media, in this case, when you look at what's happening in Ethiopia, social media, and whether it's in Cuba, under the Castro regime, whether it's in Iran or the Chinese Communist Party, I know we'll be talking about that in a minute, or in Russia, where people are oppressed, social media is really the best weapon we have against human rights violations, against oppression and tyranny, against freedom and democracy. And so anytime we can use social media, and Voice of America, we use them quite a bit in these countries that are oppressed. But I think to expose the truth, and particularly in this case, what's happening in Ethiopia, is very powerful.
Well, it's one of the few areas that you see any sort of bipartisanship in Washington, because I'm going to move to the other one where we definitely don't see that. And it looks like we just averted for a few weeks one crisis that would be a self-inflicted crisis. Senate leaders announced a deal to raise the debt limit just through December. Of course, December 3rd is also the deadline for keeping the government open. Congressman, what is going on and why would anyone want to play chicken with the U.S. national debt?
You know, I've seen this my ninth term, Bianna, and I've seen this drama, the edge of the cliff played out many times in the past. I think all members recognize that the full faith and credit of the United States is important, particularly in our ability to compete with countries like China throughout the world. I do believe it will happen. I've in the past voted for it. I think the concern right now is just the enormous amount of debt that we're going into. And now looking at another $3.5 trillion, possibly more than that, maybe $5 trillion added to our spending. We have to get control like you would with your credit card at home.
You and I both know that this is based on past accrued debt, right? And this is an issue that, as you mentioned, is being watched from our adversaries and our friends. And let me just read to you what six former defense secretaries, both Republican and Democrat, wrote in warning against just this. They said, if we default on the full faith and credit of the United States, it will send a signal to our friends and our adversaries that America does not keep its word to our military forces. We've heard this time and time again over the last few years from the Trump administration and now even into the Biden administration as to whether our allies can trust us and whether our enemies will view any sort of weakness here at home as an opportunity for them.
I agree. It's dangerous. I think it's political theater. I do think, and I agree, when you're talking about jeopardizing particularly the United States military in our, in a very dangerous world that we live in right now is disturbing. But again, and I think, Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate, has given the other side of the aisle a way out on this to do it through reconciliation. And I think at the end of the day, Bianca, either that's most likely the path that will take place. But at the end of the day, I don't see it not being raised. The full faith and credit of the United States is too important.
It just seems like unnecessary stress. But let's get into our adversaries.
There's a lot of that in Washington.
Yes, exactly. Let's get into some of the hot spots now in the world, in particular vis-a-vis China. This month, as you know, nearly 150 flights have approached the Taiwan defense zone. Now, China obviously is celebrating their own National Day, and this may have been done for more of a domestic audience. Nonetheless, you have officials from Taiwan saying that they expect that China could invade within just a couple of years, 2025. What should the U.S. be doing right now?
Well, this is really the unfinished business. They are celebrating their National Day when the Chinese Communist Party took over mainland China. Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan. The unfinished business is taking back Taiwan, and that's been very clear. And they're very straightforward about it. Hong Kong was part of it, too, and they went in and took back Hong Kong without a shot fired. And the human rights violations there, I can tell you, are very disturbing, you know, as well. I think in the case of Taiwan, deterrence is key. And if we don't have deterrence, China will go in and take over Taiwan. If China thinks they can go in and take back Taiwan without any fallout, without any resistance from the United States and our allies, they will certainly do that. We need to send a strong message that we will defend freedom and democracy and human rights in Taiwan, and that they are our ally and our partner. Any sign of weakness will invite aggression. That's an old age foreign policy doctrine. What I worry about, Bianna, is with Afghanistan and the failure of the evacuation has been seen worldwide as a sign of weakness, projecting weakness. And our allies are not trusting us as well. And our enemy adversaries like the Chinese Communist Party and Russia. If you live in Taiwan, you're very nervous now that President Xi believes that this president's not going to respond in kind when it comes to Taiwan. That's why I think the sale of the nuclear submarines that I got briefed by the administration on was so important, that our alliance with Great Britain and Australia on these nuclear submarines to protect the South China Sea and Taiwan Straits. Very important. I had the Taiwan Assurances Act, which is now, we have about a couple dozen special operators now in Taiwan. And I think if we don't, again, deterrence is a key. If we don't have a strong showing of deterrence, it is in their long-term strategy. And China's patient. They're willing to wait this out. But it's in their long-term game plan. And we have to keep that deterrence up.
Yeah, and big concern, obviously, of any sort of miscalculation. We know that President Biden and Xi will hold a virtual summit to sort of diffuse the tensions later on this year as well. Mm-hmm. Congressman, as always, great to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bianna.
Well, next, to the depths of northern Thailand, where back in 2018, the world was gripped by the life and death story of 12 schoolboys and their soccer coach trapped in a flooded cave. A new documentary delves into this story with never-before-seen footage. The Rescue, by Academy Award-winning directors and husband and wife Elizabeth Chai Sarelli and Jimmy Chin, reveals the peril of the daring mission. And here they are telling Hari Srinivasan new details about the miraculous rescue.
Bianna, thanks. Chai Vasarhelyi, Jimmy Chin, thank you both for joining us. First, I want to ask, the topic itself, it seems like the entire world watched this unfold in near real time, day after day. We had so many news reports about this. And I wonder what motivated both of you to try to take on this topic that you'd think everybody kind of knew about. Chai, let me start with you.
Well, I think like many people around the world, we were fascinated by the story as it transpired. I mean, just living through the downs, the ups. I think if you think back to 2018, you know, it was a pretty, complicated moment, you know, in the world. And here was a story that reminded us that, you know, people can come together and make the impossible happen, right? You know, and also as parents, we were very moved by the story. So I think it is one of the great stories of, you know, the past 10 years, and the characters are exactly the type of like unique characters that we like. And that there was so much that wasn't actually known about what actually happened. And we thought it was an important story to try to tell.
Jimmy?
Like Chai, we were both really moved by the story and a hopeful story, a story about our common humanity, given the divisive times that we're living through, that here was a story where people from different countries and cultures and religious backgrounds set aside their differences to, you know, do something because they felt the moral imperative to do it.
I want to play the clip of the sort of initial moment that the divers make contact with these children.
And we took our equipment off on the other side of the passage, made our way over to them. I mean, clearly John has a son, and then I haven't got children. I've structured my life to avoid children as much as possible. But John is a cub master, so he's used to dealing with groups of children.
Say thumbs up, say yay! Yay!
He got them to do a motivational exercise.
Everybody say yeah! Yeah! Excellent, say hello Americans!
Hello Americans!
Hello Thai Navy!
Hello Thai Navy!
Say hello Australians!
Hello Australians!
Hello Chinese!
Hello Chinese!
And thank you everybody else!
And thank you everybody!
Okay, we see you soon!
As we left, pretty much all of them came and hugged us individually.
I made them a promise that I would come back.
I am really happy.
We are happy too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. So where you come from?
England, UK.
As we went round the corner and kitted up, total silence between me and John, just a look into each other's faces, thinking we may be the only ones that ever see them. That was a distinct possibility. The whole journey back, all I was thinking was, what on earth are we going to do now?
Ty, when you see that footage, what goes through your head?
I get really emotional. I mean, because that the clip you just played was actually like what I called the holy grail of the clips, because John insisted. He's like, I remember filming this. I know I filmed it. And yet he'd never seen the images. So he was even beginning to question his own memory. And it's just really emotional for me because of how much work went into trying to get the material, and also just how it was the right thing to do, in that this is a story about what connects us. And being able, this footage, allow audiences the experience of what it felt like to actually be in the cave and be in that moment. I mean, that what we just watched is actually the moment where they found the children. And that's, I don't know, I always get a little choked up about it.
Yeah. Jimmy, when you're watching that and you realize this is days and days and days, the parents of these children have literally been praying, and they've been in different stages of grief and acceptance and tension, right? And the fact that those children were in there alive, you can see on their faces, they've lost weight because they haven't been eating. And it's just so remarkable that they exist. But that moment at the very end of that clip where the diver says, we might be the only ones to ever see them alive, that is so sort of real and dark.
Yeah, in that moment, I feel like there's so much complexity with the emotions that, you know, I feel and hopefully audiences feel, because there's hope, but there's also this moment that, you know, you realize even if we found the kids, there's just no way we're going to be able to get them out. And then on top of that, you see these kids, they've been sitting in the dark for 10 days with no food, and there's no complaining or crying or whimpering. How they're staying so composed in that moment, you know, so there's just a lot in that moment that I feel like hits a lot of different notes for me emotionally.
Most people, I think, when they start watching the film, they're not going to realize that it was a volunteer group that did this, right? That somehow it was this band of people that knew each other, called each other, said, you know, if I could build the best team, here's what it would require. That I mean, it's just one of those tiny details that might get kind of forgotten over time, but it's the sort of central part of this story.
We all followed it, thought we knew what happened. And really, I mean, most people, I think, don't really understand what happened and who these characters were. I think at the upper echelon of, you know, this like very fringe, esoteric sport of cave diving, it's very similar as in like high altitude climbing or alpine climbing. It's a very small community. Everybody kind of knows each other. And then realizing, oh, they're electricians, IT consultants, a meteorologist, I mean, you know, everyday guys that are coming in and they're not even getting paid. And they do this remarkable task when basically they have everything to lose if things go wrong. And they still go ahead and do it because of their, you know, moral imperative.
I want to play a clip of a little bit of an introduction to some of these divers as well. Let's take a look.
Caving is clearly about the exploration side of it. Some of the dives we do, you could be hours in, totally reliant on artificial light, artificial heating. It's like being in space. Probably the purest adventure you could have. It takes a peculiar type of person to be a cave diving explorer.
What makes someone want to be an explorer? I think it's two parts ego, one part curiosity, one part lack of confidence in yourself and the need to prove yourself. You know, maybe I was no good at footy and cricket, but at least I can, you know, cave dive quite well.
I think it's fair to say all of us were not team players. None of us are very good with ball skills.
I was a loser.
I'm terrible at team sports. I think doesn't play well with others is a phrase that you're looking for.
When the divers go in, the first people that they find were not the children. What happened there and what was that rescue like?
Well, when John and Rick first went in to Chamber 3, they discovered, you know, four water workers who had basically been asleep and missed the evacuation. So they were now trapped in the cave, the submerged cave, but they were on slightly higher ground. And, you know, Rick and John weren't sure if, you know, the cave was going to flood further. So they had to make a very split second decision saying, okay, we have to dive these guys out as soon as possible. Yeah, I think John and Rick describe it as it turned into an underwater wrestling match. I mean, just human instinct to survive. They started to, you know, basically wrestle with the divers because they thought they were, because they were submerged. The significance of that moment, though, is that they were only underwater for 30 to 40 seconds trying to get through this one submerged section. And they were adults. And they completely panicked. And what John and Rick immediately realized was we can't even get an adult to stay calm for 30 seconds underwater, much less, you know, when they later discovered we're going to have to swim these kids out for 2 to 3 hours.
The entire idea that ends up becoming the way that these kids get out, the idea to dose children with anesthesia and somehow get them kind of in a sleeping position to drag them out for 2 hours underwater. I mean, that just, you know, from the sort of initial text of the idea, you're thinking, well, clearly they must have come up with something else. Like, we're going to move on from this part of the film. But when you start watching it, you're like, they're really, this is it? This is how it happened?
As Dr. Harris's wife, Fiona, says, it's ludicrous. Like, it's just so outrageous, even the idea, but it was their only choice. When they rescued those four water workers initially, that was a real like reality check for them in that those were four adults who were underwater for 30 to 40 seconds and they panicked. So there was no other choice. And the courage it takes to actually accept that and proceed, I find astonishing.
There are moments where they realize that if anything goes wrong, they might be blamed for this, that there is kind of, you know, there's the great upside if you get the children out safely, but if you find them dead, if you have to recover their bodies, if you're not able to recover their bodies, I mean, there's so many different ways that could have turned out differently where these divers would not be considered the heroes that we're seeing them as today.
To be very clear, they really believe that saving one child would be a success. And that's what's so astonishing kind of about this idea of how they made the decisions and how selfless it was. I mean, as Jimmy said, like they had everything to lose. Like Dr. Harris would forever be known as the anesthesiologist who killed 13 people. Half of them are fathers. They know the psychic kind of psychological price they would pay. And it was still more important for them to be able to try to save these children than you couldn't live with other possibility. And that's where like the absolute morality of it really is interesting, because like they were their best selves. And if we all could be our best selves and act with acts of generosity, like we'd be in a very different place right now as a society.
Chai, we should mention that there was a fatality in this. A former member of the Thai Navy died during this rescue operation, and you were able to sit down with his widow in a just really compelling and moving interview. I mean, here's a guy who looked in otherwise amazing shape, right? I mean, not just from his years of training, but even afterwards, he had volunteered to do this and bring wetsuits down there to these kids. What was it like kind of discovering things about his life and what he was like?
I mean, it's heartbreaking the more you learn about Saman. And it's also Saman Gunan's, you know, kind of selfless act of like volunteering to come back and help the Thai Navy SEALs. I mean, he'd been retired for 18 years or something. He'd last served in 2003. It's so emblematic of the story itself in that it's an act of generosity. And no one really had ever confirmed how Saman had died. And it's part of our efforts of speaking to everybody involved, including the Admiral of the Thai Navy SEALs. Like we were finally able to confirm that he was taking in these wetsuits. And I mean, it would be a very, very difficult task because of the buoyancy of the wetsuit. So he had already delivered them and was on his way back when he ran out of air. And I had the chance to, you know, to sit with his widow. And also, I mean, really, after I met her, she gave us his phone. So all that footage is actually footage from his phone. And that also was like a strange way of like looking into somebody's life where you feel like it's so intimate. But we never had the chance to actually meet him.
Watching the film, you realize all of the other things that were kind of at stake here beyond just the kid's life. If that wasn't important enough, you had kind of this geopolitical layer, you had this spiritual layer, you had just the grief of the parents. I mean, there were so many things kind of swirling around that site.
It's a very complicated story. And who's to say the prayers didn't save the children, right? And so that was part of our intention always, was to try to honor the complexity of the story and honor the East-West situation, honor the miscommunications, because it really just demonstrates how, like, you know, against all odds, these people came together to save the children. I actually walked the cave and I walked to the back of the cave. And until I saw it for myself, I didn't, You can't understand just the sheer scale. And when you see it, you understand why you needed thousands of people supporting these 10 divers.
Jimmy, were you surprised by how close it all came? I mean, near the end, you know, there's this moment where as an audience member, you're saying, oh, thank goodness I got the kids. And then all of a sudden people are like rushing out of the cave because guess what? Like if we had waited another day, maybe this whole thing would have been a much more tragic story.
Yeah, in many ways, it was miracle upon miracle that happened. I truly believe, and I know that the divers believe this too, at any given moment over those days during the rescue, something could have gone horribly wrong, catastrophically wrong, like any moment around any turn. And they had to be perfect too. You know, just one bump on their face masks. There's no redundancy in that system. It's like, you know, if that thing leaks and fills with water, it's over. And, you know, they're moving them for 2 to 3 hours through these caves. It's just incredible.
Shai Vasarhelyi and Jimmy Chin, the film is called The Rescue. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Wow, all those details makes that rescue all the more incredible. And The Rescue is out in theaters tomorrow. Well, now from the caves to the stars. Imagine going into outer space just as the pandemic started, only to return months later to a whole new earthly reality. Well, that was the case for Chris Cassidy. The NASA astronaut took his final space mission last April to the International Space Station in a quest to help find the origins of the universe. It's all captured in a new Disney docuseries called Among the Stars. Here's the clip.
Houston Station, the hatch is closed.
Karen, we copy. You guys have a good time out there, okay?
Thanks a lot, Karen. Nice work. Thanks, Karen.
We're ready. Let's go do a spacewalk.
3, 2, 1.
Wow. And Chris Cassidy joins me now from Arlington, Texas. Chris, welcome to the program. What a career. What a life. I want to hear about your next chapter now that you've retired as an astronaut. But we should tell our viewers that before being an astronaut, you were, a Navy SEAL, just your typical Navy SEAL. You deployed 4 times, 2 times in Afghanistan, twice in the Mediterranean. But let's talk about your career as an astronaut. You were an astronaut for 18 years. What was it like to finally see that come to an end?
Well, first of all, great to be with you and excited for viewers to see behind the scenes of what it takes as a team effort to get crews to space. And it's an international effort with folks all around the globe. And that's the highlight, really, of my 18 years as an astronaut. I have individual personal experiences, but I feel like those are shared with the whole NASA workforce and international partners. In those 18 years, 3 trips to space, once on a shuttle, 2 times launching on a Russian Soyuz, and the most recent one you said in the beginning during COVID, which was a great place to be off the planet during the pandemic.
So how did the series come about? I mean, we should note you were the 500th person in space. I really like that round number there. But this was your final mission. How did you come about having it documented?
Well, it wasn't about me. There's an experiment that was on the International Space Station, is on the International Space Station, which is featured in the program called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. Very expensive, very high-end science, cutting-edge science, really, that's looking deep into the universe for its origins. And that machine was failing and needed repair, a serious, complex repair. And so the initial idea was to capture this effort. How do we do this repair? How do we conduct the spacewalks? When will it be done? And that was the onset of the program. But with anything, it's about the people, right? And once the documentary crew got involved and realized the amazing stories that weave together, it sort of evolved into what it is now, a 6-part series.
What's so important about this is that it really highlights what takes place on the International Space Station and all of the scientific work and research that not only you, but as you say, so many others collaborate on. And in this time where there's so much tension in the world, one could always look to NASA and astronauts and the International Space Station as a place where you have people come together from around the world. Let's just show a brief clip of what you described you were working on.
The International Space Station is an orbital laboratory. It really is about 2 things, making life on Earth better.
And Luca, for the next activity, we're gonna try.
And enabling us to go beyond low Earth orbit.
Okay, this is the veggie experiment, growing plants in space. The great thing about this payload, this experiment, is that when we're all done, we get to eat this.
When we were there 6 years ago,
we were not running nearly the number of experiments that are happening now. Now it's like nonstop. So that's exciting.
What was the most exciting experiment that you worked on?
Oh my goodness, there's so many, but I think anything that has to do with things growing, whether it's or all alive things, you know, a plant, lettuce, different types of animals. We had spiders. I've even seen fish in space. And it's really, really fascinating to see what you're used to seeing with your Earth viewpoint, how that same life grows and adapts and deals with the absence of gravity and the environment in space. It's quite fascinating. So all the things related to growing and living things are my favorite.
How's the food up there?
You know, it's pretty good. People often think that we're squirting like goo out of a tube and, you know, get our
baby
calories
food,
this way.
Right.
No, it's not like that. The food is made in the food lab in Houston, actually in multiple labs around the world from the different partner nations. And it's quite good. I mean, I love to eat and think about there's a wall of food that you can just grab, add some water to it. And 5 minutes later, you're eating pretty much anything you want. So it's tasty.
Yeah, well, that is interesting because it doesn't look as tasty as you say it is. I'm glad that you've broken that down for us. As we mentioned, you went on this last journey just as we were really falling into the depths of the pandemic here at home. And just from your perspective, literally out of this world, what was that like for you? Just following any headlines that you could to see what was transpiring back here on Earth?
Well, it was interesting. My wife and I flew from Houston to Moscow at the end of February. And if you remember, that was still sort of normal airport travel at that time. A week or two later is when everything started to shut down. And that's when I realized there would be no launch guests coming to to Kazakhstan to watch the launch. No NASA support. In fact, my wife had to make a hard decision. She flew back at the early before the launch at the risk of being stuck in Kazakhstan after I launched without no way to get back to the United States. And then the ironic part is there's a robust system of support, emotional and psychological support for astronauts in space put on by NASA and comes in lots of forms. But I felt like this mission, I was actually the emotional support for my friends and family as I would call them, email them, ask, you know, we can watch TV, recorded TV that's sent up to us. So we were well aware of the news and the situation. But it was really fascinating to talk to my friends and family and loved ones about their feelings during it.
Yeah, every day was Groundhog Day here and we were all shut down. And it must have been a completely different experience for you as you were, yes, in tight quarters, but you were actually working on some of these very important experiments. On the issue of space tourism, I mean, we keep hearing not only about billionaires going up into space, but them expanding this and at one day having an opportunity for average everyday Americans or people from around the world and tourists to be able to go to space. We just saw a headline that William Shatner confirmed he'll be joining Blue Origin. He'd be the oldest person to go into space at 90. How do you feel about this? As we noted, you were the 500th person. So to go from that to this becoming perhaps something much more common.
Well, that's a great question. I'm asked about this very often. But if you think about it in whatever, maybe the 1950s, it was not common for families to get on an airplane and go on vacation. You drove everywhere. Now, that's what you do. You buy your family tickets and you shop around for the best market rate and off you go to Hawaii or Florida or wherever you choose for your destination. And I don't know if it's going to be in that same whatever 70-year time frame, but it could be where the family now is like, hey, you guys want to go to Hawaii for Christmas or would you like to go to space for a weekend? I believe that will happen. Right now, it's only accessible to high net worth folks and the tickets are really expensive, but it will come down and it will be more affordable and everybody can enjoy it. And I really believe that the world would be better off if each and every one of us has 5 minutes to look out that window and see Earth for all its beauty.
Yeah, that would be quite something. This is a question I have yet to ask, but what does one do after they retire from being a Navy SEAL and an astronaut? What's next for you?
Well, that's a great question. I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And then the job that I'm currently in kind of was that answer and everything. I'm now the president and CEO of the National Medal of Honor Museum Foundation, which we're building a museum in Arlington, Texas, for our nation's highest medal for valor, which will include a leadership institute to carry on the characteristics and values that the recipients have, and a monument on the Mall in Washington, D.C. So it's to me, it's like continuing to serve the nation just outside of uniform, and it's a really great home for me.
Well, listen, growing up in Houston, I always loved the field trips going to the Johnson Space Center. And here I get to talk to somebody who actually was an astronaut. Thank you so much for, as you mentioned, all the service that you've offered to
My
this
pleasure.
Country. We appreciate it. Thank you. Among the Stars is available to stream on Disney Plus. And finally, we turn to one of literature's most prestigious honors, the Nobel Prize. This year's, it was Tanzanian novelist Abdul Razak Gurnah who won the award. The Academy praised him for his, quote, uncompromising and compassionate take on the effects of colonialism. The writer famously tackled issues like displacement and asylum, which inspired the committee, given the years-long migrant crisis in Europe. Gurnah is actually the first African writer to win the prize in almost 20 years. Well-deserved congratulations to him. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.